So the peptide binding problem on which I'll speak today is motivated by the following. Peptides are easily manufactured, and they are generally, some of them are promising vaccines. In fact, all known vaccines are essentially coming from peptides. But there's a lot of them. And so the question is, when will they create an immune reaction of the T cells and other cells in the body for appropriate diseases? And in this process, the most important step is, that's what they say, is will it bind to one of these MHC2 cells in the body? So that's the peptide binding problem. And so immunologists and we in particular are looking for algorithms which predict the binding in for appropriate, we say, alleles and for which peptides bind. And let me first of all mention people I've worked with on this. I have a group of 10 or a dozen people, changes sometimes, which we meet twice every week for an hour, hour and a quarter to discuss the mathematics of this problem and results, numerical simulations, predictions, and so on. We've been doing this for a year and a half. And here are the people, Raymond Long, Chuen Wu, Shao, and Wenjun Shen. These are the core. These are the core that started this project with me a year and a half ago. And there's been quite a few contributions by other members of the 10, but I would say it's fair to select out this core of three people besides myself. Okay, so I introduced this a little bit in my first lecture here on Monday, this topic, and now I want to be a little more systematic on what we're doing. So the idea is, our point of view is to start with the amino acids, not start with at any other level, not start with the folded proteins, not start with the DNA, double helices, but start at this level of amino acid chains. It's not unusual, but not everybody does that because one has several choices as to what one takes is fundamental for us. It's the amino acid chains, and I try to convince you that's reasonable. Okay, so amino acid chains are strings of letters from a certain alphabet of 20 amino acids, which we call script A. So this is the set of the basic amino acids, 20. So the size of this finite set is 20. And the chains are, if I call amino acid, let's say X belongs to here. I can write X1, X2, X3, and so on up to some finite number. This is an amino acid chain. It's just like computer science sequences of zeros and ones or some other alphabet. In this case, it's an alphabet of 20 objects. So we want to do, ultimately, geometry on this space. We want to take a point of view of looking at the geometry on finite spaces. So this is going to replicate classical geometry to a great extent. That's the idea. Eventually, we want geometry to be represented by a certain type of a metric, existence function. And with this geometry, which represents some kind of unsupervised learning, or what we could call a good kernel, a good distance function. So this is something that differs from most of the talks here. We work mostly to finding a good kernel appropriate to the problem of immunology. It's not just something, the points just don't lie in Euclidean space, and we use a Euclidean space inner product. First of all, the points, these points and the chains, they don't lie in Euclidean space at all. They're finite objects. They're not in Euclidean space until we have a kernel. Once we have a kernel, then there's a representation in Euclidean space. But as they stand, they're not in Euclidean space. They're just a finite set. And so that, well, anyway, that's our point of view. So we're going to be working finding geometries, in particular, of these chains of various lengths of amino acids. Okay? So I want to start with a geometry on A itself. And we can see already what that means. I'm going to define a kernel. I'll say kernel. It could be the same thing as a reproducing kernel in our context on A. So that's going to be a map K from A cross A into the real numbers, symmetric, positive, and positive definite. It can be represented as a matrix, anything out here as a representation as a matrix. We want that matrix to be positive definite. Okay? So, and this is where all the biology enters, essentially, that we use. So this is a key thing for us because that's where the medicine enters. That's what we strive to prove, in fact, that the other questions are secondary to the biology that comes in just at that stage. So the philosophy, in some sense, of building a nice kernel is to start with something on a fundamental unit and go from there, develop a geometry on the strings. That's the idea. This oversimplifies things a little bit, but maybe not too much. All right, so what we do is the following. This is something, because it is so fundamental and so important, is something that the biologists and medical doctors have focused on very, very much. So there's a huge number of studies on what is an appropriate kernel. And I'm not using exactly the same language as the biologists, but they have written papers on such symmetric functions. And so what we did, this was towards the beginning of our study, spent some time in trying to understand which are the most important kernels on amino acids, because we have a choice of 100. And we looked at what other people had done, their analyses, and what we eventually looked at is something called BLOSSOM. We looked at BLOSSOM 62. So BLOSSOM is a sequence of kernels with this with a number like this. We looked at BLOSSOM 62. I'm going to describe that a little bit. Okay, BLOSSOM 62 is not what we really use, but we use the data that is used to define this. So we go through a little different development than what is usually used for various reasons. And so I want to start with a matrix. I used to call this pre-BLOSSOM. It's a raw data for BLOSSOM. Q, A cross A, into R. So Q is something produced by the by BLOSSOM before they write down the BLOSSOM similarity. It's obtained by processes which we don't have to go into too much here. They're blocks of aligned amino acids. And this is done, defined especially when these are not peptides, not even alleles, but they're proteins, which is kind of a large class of amino acid chains. Maybe the most universal is a set of proteins. And so on the amino acids themselves, we will start with Q, which we could call pre-blossom. It's positive, and it's produced by looking at these aligned proteins and biological properties of blocks of these aligned proteins. So the blossom stands for blocks, and I don't know what else this stands for. So these are blocks of aligned proteins, and it's done by a big counting process. And they have this thing that seems to work very well in biology. But Q is the starting point here, and what we'll do is it's positive, so it could be thought of as a measure on the product space. So that's what we want to do. Think of it as a measure on the product space. It's a positive matrix, always positive, on the product. So we can think of that as a measure, and we normalize it. Let's just assume it's normalized to make it an honest probability measure. So we just divide it by the sum of all values. Okay, so now Q is a probability measure on the product space. All right, so the next stage, following partly the developers of Blossom, is to take Q and we look at the associated marginal measure. So we define P, I'll say P of X, for X belonging to A. It's going to be a measure on A, the marginal measure of our normalized Q, and you can just write this as, I write integral for sum, Q of X, Y, dy, over the uniform measure on A. Okay, so that gives us a non-uniform measure on A. Okay, so the next thing is, I just note, in connection with Amit Singer's last talk, if we took the matrix Q, X, Y, and divide it by P of X, this is a stochastic matrix by construction, always stochastic. And so what we're doing is, in some sense, shadowing a little bit of a Markov partition, a random walk, but in some sense. But that is true that this is stochastic. As a matrix, it's a stochastic matrix, and the random walks are relevant to what we do. We don't always know how or such things, because many, many things we don't know. But what we'll do is consider the associated matrix P of Y, and let that be K of XY. So we're looking at a normalization of the original pre-blossom. Okay? Let's call that, that's beginning to be it's positive definite. One can prove that. Actually, I think the blossom people and most people never worry whether it was positive definite, but for us that's important. And it is positive definite, and it gives rise to a lot of associated positive definite matrices. So we can talk about eventually the associated reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces. All right. So we have K of XY, and for reasons inspired by medical researchers, what we'll do is to take this to a beta power, where beta is a positive parameter. This is the Hadamard power. And beta usually ranges around 0.1 for us, 0.12, and it is a mystery. It would be nice if we could just take a diffusion parameter here, and maybe we could. So we've done a lot of experiments, but not enough so that we can depart from this structure, this Hadamard power. And the Hadamard power is still positive definite. Using terms in the literature, non-trivial terms in the literature, one proves that this is positive definite. So strictly speaking, this we can call K1 beta. Beta we choose to be around 0.1, depending on whether how big these strings are. If the strings are longer, then we make beta a little smaller. And I wish we understood those things better. But we understand so many things empirically, because there is some medical data about peptide binding. So one can check predictions. And the trouble is there's not nearly enough data. That's why we want good methods to predict new data. But the data that exists is enough to help guide us. So we can use the data that exists to say, check that we're making good sense with this kernel and with what beta and so on. Okay, so be sure to stop me if you have questions of what I'm doing. All right, so this is a kernel then. This is our kernel on our finite space A. And sometimes I'll just call it K1, because beta will be fixed in general. Okay, so now I want to build a kernel on the strings, all strings of amino acids. And so I do this, as some of you will recall from last time, I write K2 of UV. These are strings of length, same length. So here, U has length equal to V, and if that length is a positive integer K, we call this a K-mer. We then say that U is a K-mer. So here we have two K-mers, same K. And here we just take the product, tensor product kernel, or a lot of different names for it because it comes so much into tensor analysis. So this is simply, I call it tensor product kernel. It's the product of K1 of UI, VI, I going from 1 to K, where I write U equals U1 up to UK, no matter where it comes from. This U may eventually come as part of a very long string. We might say this could be UK lying right in the middle of some future string to be discussed. Okay? But we, for this, we use this notation. The first element of the K-mer U is U1. It goes consecutively up to K. All right, so this is pretty simple. This is pretty simple, and we only have one more level to go before we get the general kernel. I think I'm doing everything today, not everything today, but everything so far, and trying to keep things pretty precise. So everything I'm saying now is exact mathematics and exactly what we do. So K3, let's call those strings up there, all strings. You could write it this way, sigma KU over all K positive, but sigma K equals strings of strings or chains of length K. The length of a string is just how many letters in that string. And so this is really infinite, I suppose, but it's infinite in a sense which is very superficial, and not infinite in the sense that we care about. We're always working with finite sets here. Okay, for K3 then, it will of course depend on everything so far, which is mainly this beta. I want to write here now two strings, FG, belong to, let's call this sigma. As I say, we're only going to be worried about finite parts of it, but kernels, positive definite kernels, reproducing kernels, all these things, they restrict to substrings, subsets. Okay, so I want to write this. And this, these will be finite, and eventually we can just restrict this to any finite set of strings. So this is by definition. This is a sum of K2 of UV for U and V. I'm using this notation, which is pretty clear. There U is going to be a substring of F, V is a substring of G, and when I say substring, I mean no gaps in the substring. It's consecutive elements of this chain. And I'll say okay. Of course, I want U to have the same length as V equals K. I think this is all correct, but I'm using this notation. So that defines our kernel K3 on all strings. And I want to actually use the kernel in our experiments on K hat 3. K hat is a normalization of any kernel K hat of XY equals K of XY divided by K of XX. KYY square root. This is a normalization which gives a correlation of two vectors. You think of K sub X as being the function of Y defined this way. These are vectors, and this normalizes those vectors to lie on the unit sphere in the positive orthant. And let me just remind ourselves that K sub X belongs to a certain function space, functions on sigma, well, I'll put 3 here, K3 of X applied to point Y is simply K3 of X and Y. So this gives a representation called a feature representation of a space X, for example, sigma, with values and the functions on sigma. Yeah?
So is there any need to, when you're setting up K3, to normalize by the length of the K-vector?
No, not for the moment at least. You could work without this normalization. Oh, yeah, that's a little different question. It's a good question, and something that has worried us a huge amount. We spent a huge amount of power in our computers trying to analyze that without success. I think the main, so one, first of all, does one want to use all K here? And that's a question that's not at all obvious. In fact, 6 months ago, I would have thought that it's better not to use all K. And the only reason we found for not using all K is a complexity reason. The machines take too long if you use all K sometimes. So we don't know. If one puts a waiting here, put a K here, or waiting in some other way. We don't know. Yeah, question? Yeah, it's a similarity measure between two amino acids. Like every kernel is a similarity. When it gets close to one, say, then that means that the two amino acids are very close to each other, very similar. And so what this does is you can think of it, it's not exactly the derivation of this particular one, but it measures how easy it is for amino acid X to mutate to amino acid Y among the 20. That's not symmetric, but you can make it symmetric. And so that's the first approximation of understanding this. It's not the way it's defined. Some of these kernels on A are defined in terms of mutations. Some of them are. This one was defined only indirectly in terms of mutations. But that would be the closest intuition one would have. See, if it mutates very quickly, that means it doesn't, you know, you're going to have to trade that amino acid off relative to the one that mutates very easily. So it shouldn't affect too much the properties of the kernel. That's the idea. Okay, and this normalization, it's just not obvious that we use this normalization. I just comment, though, if we use this normalization at the stage K1, that wipes out the structure. It annihilates the probability measure. So one has to be careful. This normalization, the correlation normalization, annihilates the probability measure and ever after. So we don't want to do that. And so there is this probability measure, P of X, on the space of amino acids. By the product measure, it gives a measure on the k-mers for each k, and a lot of questions after that. So there is a measure on the k-mers, just given by this product. And this measure, this k2 respects that. Well, a lot of things one can say, some of which are less important than others. Okay, so anyway, what I've done so far is describe rigorously the kernel that we use. So this defines a what I call geometry. We could say on sigma, instead of all strings, we have the distance between two strings, so x and y are strings of any length, finite. You can say that's equal to, 2 minus 2 k hat of x, k hat 3 x, y. That's a canonical distance function. I think that's exactly right. And here we have an inner product. On this space, this function space, this is a Hilbert space, K, called the reproducing kernel Hilbert space. K is a kernel, and the inner product here is defined by the following. We take a basis of functions, K sub X. So we take K sub X, inner product, K sub y, 3. These as x varies over the basis elements of sigma. This defines a basis of this function space, and I want to put an inner product on that. That is going to be given k of x, k 3 x y. And because of positivity, that's a good inner product called the reproducing kernel inner product. And so this is just using the associated distance function to that geometry that I just described. So there are different ways of describing the geometry. And we use both. We can use it in terms of this HK structure, this inner product space, or we could use it in terms of this distance function. That's just distance in the inner product space. Okay, I'm going through these things pretty fast. All right. So, I'm going to talk now about the peptide binding problem. So here's the binding affinity. I haven't used the symbol A for amino acids, so it leaves me free to use the symbol A. I want to use that for alleles. Okay, so alleles can be confused easily with genes. They're a representation of a gene in an individual, for example. Or they say sometimes a variant of a gene. And there are a lot of alleles because alleles are pretty diverse. We work on human populations, so there are a lot of alleles in human populations. And we're working with a certain class of alleles corresponding to the main class of unknown diseases called sometimes HLA. And the hardest part, these are human leukocyte. I lose track of the names. So this is HLA, sometimes you say MHC2. Okay, so these are HLA and MHC2. So these are alleles and variants of genes in the human body. And we're working with these. So these correspond to DRB. That's what we're looking at, this class of alleles. Okay, so there are a lot, as I mentioned. Not too many genes, just a few, when I specify that sequence. But the number of alleles is the following. We're going to use databases described this way. These are databases you can find on the internet easily. And we use those databases a lot. And they're about 800. 800 of them. So it's a database of 800, highly studied and highly updated from time to time. Yeah, I have one right. I brought one here. This is a database, looks like this. And they just list them all out, all the 800. And I spend so much time looking through that list, you can't believe it. Because that it's part of the data of our experiments, which one of these alleles you're working with. Okay, and so these alleles depend, you know, to different diseases, and they come in certain populations. In certain, you know, populations in Western Europe or Ireland, you'll get the appearance of this allele, and after that, it only goes through emigration. So alleles are connected a lot with the history, life history of these genes and the variants, the alleles, which look differently in different populations. And there's 800 altogether that are a big puzzle for understanding. Because we want to know, when does a peptide bind to a given allele in this group? So what we want to do is to look at the binding affinity function. So it's going to be defined, say, with capital F from a space of peptides. Peptides are fragments of proteins associated to various diseases or viruses. Yes, question? The alleles, that's a very good question. I want to put more and more numbers down. The alleles are generated by a double helix originally, and it has a representation through genetic code. And eventually, one wants to normalize an allele because it's hard to say where's the beginning and the end. And so what we do is to take these alleles with a normalization. I forget the numbers of the normalization, but it's probably going to be around length after this normalization of about 100, maybe 81. Yeah, so I think they're normalized to have length 81. So that means they're normalized to have a significant beginning and end, and they come from a part of the double helix, which makes it natural to make this normalization. So this is, I should emphasize, a representation that it took us a while to find, representation of length 100. See, originally in the database, they could be length 200. What? Oh, these are lengths of the string. Or length, I mean the string, yeah. Length of the string for the representation we take of an allele. Thanks, good. Yeah, so, yeah, question? No, nucleotides, no. See, the genetic code takes four nucleotide chains into amino acid chains. We always use the amino acid chain representation. Yeah, but it could come from the nucleotides. But that's one thing we believe in. We believe we start at the level of amino acid chains. So there is, you can go back in this development or go forward to a protein which is folded. It's more structure, and it's important to understand its function to see the folded version. It has a molecular 3D structure. So you can take the allele and do that, or any protein and do that, or you can go back to the representation as part of a double helix. You can do all those things. So one has a choice. Where does one start? So we start with the amino acid chains, which are partly in between. Which are in between. Good questions. Yeah. Well, the trouble is there is no starting codon. So one has to do some alignment in between to get a good starting point. And so they come from a very particular part, eventually looking way back, of the gene. Okay, all good questions. And now we can take peptides. Are fragments of proteins which are connected with diseases, viruses, bacteria, and other things that represent cancer, perhaps. So peptides are short. Proteins are pretty long. There are sequences of length 1,000 or more. Typically, some thousand, a few thousand, maybe. Those are proteins. They're the most long strings and the most universal of what we discuss. So alleles, you can think of, in principle, as a protein of a particular type associated to a gene. A peptide is a fragment of a protein. Protein associated to a virus, say. And the idea of a vaccine is, going back to the first vaccine, that fragment of that virus or bacteria gives you immunization. You don't give the whole full length virus, because then you get the patient gets very sick. If you give them appropriate part of it, then they are protected, because that stimulates the T cells to kill the real viruses. That's the idea. Okay, so now these peptides, they're associated oftentimes to a certain allele. So if you have an allele A, we see databases of peptides which are candidates for getting an immune reaction to get, for that allele A. See, it's a binding to the surface of the allele, cell associated to the allele. So that's what binds a peptide to part of this allele. And one wants to know if it binds or not. Binding is preliminary to getting an immune response. Fair enough? Okay. So we could write FA is going to be this binding function that goes from piece of A allele. This just goes into the interval 0, 1. We always take the real version, the regression function, not binding or not binding. Okay, so this is what, for our given allele, this is the peptide binding function. And so this is what we worked on for a while. This is a fixed allele theory. This is what most biologists and computer scientists have worked on, the fixed allele theory. And so we want to predict this. This is going to be approximately 100, at most 500 length peptides. No, not length. The length is about 15, and the number of peptides is about 100. Maybe 1,000. Okay, and so this is the focus of most of the work on the peptide binding function is this focus. Okay, so what we have is a geometry now on the space of peptides itself using this kernel on peptides. So we could put this geometry on the space of peptides given A. We fix an allele, for which there is medical data. There aren't too many. There's some. And this is following what experimenters have done in this subject. And so we want to understand this function for that allele, this function on a space of 100 points, or a few hundred. Okay, so the idea is, how do we find this? So everything I'm talking about now is unsupervised learning theory. That's what I call this construction of K3, because we're not using labeled data. We're using unlabeled data. I talked about this Monday. Construction of K3, a good kernel. So our belief, and we have confirmation, this is a good kernel. Reflects the medicine. Reflects the biology, and has a lot to do, with all these K1, K2, K3s. Okay? And so once one has a good kernel, then one can do the following. Now we take a subset X bar contained in this peptide database. Could be all, could be most or half, for which there is medical data, which means we have labeled data for this binding function. This doctors have done. They found this. And so X bar consists XI, YI, where XI belongs to the space of peptides here, PA, YI belongs to the interval 0, 1. If Y is bigger than, say, half, it's binding. Less than a half is not binding, roughly speaking. All right? Oh, my, this is a tough one. Okay, now we have all this. What we do is to use supervised learning algorithms, which I worked on for 10 years, even recently. So we're using that to get this predictive function. So that means the following. We choose a certain parameter lambda, let's say by cross-validation or empirically, and we look at the minimization over all f belonging to, I'll just write hk, this is hk3, so it's reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces, space of functions on PA with this inner product. And so what we want to do is minimize this functional f of xi minus yi squared plus lambda, then we can write f in this k-norm. This is where the k plays a crucial role. It's a good kernel, and it gives a measure on the on f, a norm squared. So we minimize f for this. So this is the data, and that gives us, for appropriate lambda, a good approximation of what we want. That's the theory. And here we're mixing up theory and practice all along. We're mixing up the theory with our experiments. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So this is the algorithm for appropriate lambda. And that's given, as is usually done, not theoretically, but by experiment cross-validation. Okay, so that's our, in this context, that's our binding prediction. So I've given a pretty good sketch of how we get a binding affinity for a given allele. Okay, so it wasn't, well, pretty soon, we're comparing what we're doing with what others have done in the literature. And so in this day I've just written, we get what they call state of the art. Given by this prediction. So this is better than what other bioinformatics people have done. The best to date was done by Nielsen and his co-workers, Nielsen in Denmark, and Lund and others. And they were using an algorithm very complicated and much more biological information than we use. They were using nonlinear neural networks. And you can't even find their algorithm because it's complicated, and they just more or less state their results. And theirs was the best to date. So ours, for me, it has this amazing simplicity. The algorithm is extraordinarily simple, and it gives the best results. Strictly speaking, if you look at the group which is people have tested, I think there's maybe a testing set of, I forget, 16 alleles where there's all this data, and on the 16 alleles, I think we do better on about 12, they do better on 2, and there's a couple a little bit ambiguous. Okay, so in some sense, that gives us a good picture, but there are, this is in some sense, it's the beginning of the story. Because what we really want is to put all these peptides together, put all the alleles together, so we get the peptide binding affinity defined on the space of all peptides, 30,000 that are in common use, and even new ones that don't even fit here. So here's 3,000 peptides cross the space of all the alleles. This is going to be 800 alleles. And for each pair, you want to find the binding affinity for some function. So this is a little trickier, quite a bit trickier. And here the one problem is you don't have so much data for this big set. You don't have so much data. So eventually you're going to look at this on a smaller set. But even then, here we're varying the allele and the peptide both. So this is where we start using a stability results on these functions, where you start using these Lipschitz constants to measure the stability and a few other things. And again, it's Nielsen for this problem is called pan various things, pan allele, because you're varying the alleles in this problem. So this has been studied maybe only by Nielsen and his co-workers. And so we had to work hard to compete with Nielsen's result on this. And so our results at this point are just better than Nielsen's, a little bit. These things are measured in terms of the third decimal point. Yeah. What's that? Oh, here? So this goes over all the labeled peptides. So this goes from I, maybe, say, up to, it could be most of the peptides. So it goes something like 1 to 100. Yeah. Depends, you know, depending on A, you get a different peptide database, but could be that. Uh-huh. Yeah. So this pan allelic problem is much more sophisticated. And we certainly worked very hard to get a clear picture of superiority of over Nielsen and his workers. And as I say, it comes out to just the third decimal point between 0 and 1. Yes. Yeah, because there is a database, and one uses cross-validation, a five-fold, what they call five-fold experiment. So you take all the data and divide it into five classes. Then you use four of the classes to get a prediction, test it on the fifth class. And you do that for each of the classes, and then you put it all together. And you get, that's the way everybody tests. Or you can just say, leave one out. And then test it, but that's not quite as good as this five-fold validation. No, this is only over where there's known data. You can only do this where you have known data. Oh no, the data we use a common database when we do these comparisons. Databases in the literature. There are databases for all these. Oh no, it's more complicated. You're averaging a lot of areas under the curve and such things as that. So you're taking some agglomerate of the things that you've tested and cross-validation. So it's a little complicated process to how do you compare things. But it has to do with cross-validation. You leave out 20%, then you do some averaging in areas under the curve, and then you check the numbers. Yeah, AUC, and then you get, eventually you get an average over everything that you can measure. Yeah. Oh, we're tuning it all the time. We've achieved this by extensive tuning because there's all kinds of parameters that are coming into this. Well, the main parameters are this WK up there. if it seems well, you just take all the WK1, take all the K, and the beta, for the beta we take 0.12 for the peptides, 0.1 for the alleles. Yeah, and there's other things we can look at, and we look at them. Look at different representations for these 800. There's all kinds of ideas, looking at the entropy considerations to maybe weed out some of the, yeah. Yeah.
At least heuristically, there are ways of thinking that the sequence of kernels are somehow corresponding to the visual system.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we did in our first paper.
I'm curious, does the three-stage kernel have any sort of biological reasons why it might correspond to something actually going on in biochemistry?
Oh, yeah, because of the construction is based on these alignments. See, what this does is align all the K-mers in one versus another in a very thorough way. Yeah, so there's that's all the background in the biology are alignments of subsequences. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's something we're researching out now. Yeah, a big way I phrase it to my group of 10 is suppose we take in one of these chains, one of these big chains here or here, and suppose we just take one place, we have a mutation. And so that comes in pretty complicated way to K3. So the problem, and I think it's doable, but it takes some work. How is that going to affect the dysfunction? That's where the Lipschitz analysis is part of that. But it's quite a bit of work to go from a mutation here to this kernel distance function. It's tricky because this definition of K3 is I wrote it down pretty fast. But it's gone, is it? Maybe up here. No? I don't know. It's gone. I wrote it quickly, but it's a complex thing. Yeah, question?
Yeah, so you have numbers for your positive predictive value or your negative predictive value?
Oh, yeah, we have numbers. I have them in fact right here. Yeah, I have a lot of numbers. Yeah. Which set of alleles? Oh, the alleles we use the kernel on alleles. Same kernel. We did a lot of experimentation, but we use the same kernel on the alleles in this special form, where you're looking only at a sequence of 80 with a good initial point. Yeah, no deletions. Yeah, this is tensor product again. Kernel here, we take the tensor product. Associated metric to that. Yeah. Okay, anyway, I'll stop. But I just want to mention one thing that we're spending an awful lot of time nowadays is to use a clustering algorithm, and we use K hat 3 on the space of alleles, allele space. We want to cluster the alleles. So we use a little new clustering algorithm. It starts, I always forget the name of it, it's used a lot in some form. If you take all the alleles in their own cluster, so you have 800 clusters at the beginning, then you go up a tree by aggregation. I forget the name of that. Everybody here knows it except me. What's that called?
Hierarchy.
Yeah, maybe there's another name. Okay. Linkage. Yeah. And there's a single linkage, and then you can use maximum, you can use average. We do the same basic idea, but we use a different, I think much better, aggregating thing, and that is the Hausdorff distance on subsets. Because that's, first of all, that's a metric, and the other ones are not metrics on the set of subsets. So we find the best results, and also it's more satisfactorily from the point of view of mathematics, to take this Hausdorff distance function to say when two clusters should coalesce. And when we do that, we get pretty fantastic results, because there are stereotypes that biologists have classified these alleles. When are the two of them are going to be closely related as far as the diseases are caused. And they have a huge amount of research, biological research, medical research, into this grouping of what they call stereotypes. And what's amazing is we get essentially the same grouping without using any extra medical knowledge. Just using the information in our K3 hat, we get a very good, in some places it's quite amazing. And we don't understand why so much, but it looks like there's a lot of power just in the K1. That's where most of biology is, except for some alignment here. And just from that, we're able to tell the medical aspects of different alleles. Eventually we'll say if one responds to a certain peptide, then those in that same grouping have a good chance of responding to it. So anyway, that's what we're working on a lot now. Yeah. I have no idea. See, we don't know what Nielsen does because it's buried in the algorithms you can't even read. Huh? Yeah, no, we study Nielsen some and get some of what he's doing, and it's been helpful. So I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there some more questions? Okay, well, it's not, we always present to our special lecturers a little field Luke bag of
And so, thanks very much, Ed. Okay, very good.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the wonderful talks. And,
okay, well, thank you for inviting me in.
Okay, so let's thank him.